Yeah, I have the austere pleasure to be the last presenter, who actually they thought wasn't even supposed to be here. And so I also have no financial disclosures, and the farm actually did not make enough again this year to be any kind of a to be any kind of a conflict. That is Larry and Jed there, though, and they're a team. Yeah, that's all anybody cares about right now. Nobody really cares how much it costs to recruit. Oh, dear. What the heck? So, low back pain is a public health problem. There you go. Do we need to talk about any more? I do think that this is interesting, and we were just at the Musculoskeletal Summit, and this also is from the Burden of... I'm sorry, this is from Deo's article. But we do see rising numbers of cost and procedures being done for back pain. We know that low back pain patients have a higher rate of baseline comorbidities and resource use as compared to controls. But I think that we've also talked about this today, that there are reasons for that. And I thought that excellent job done, Jonathan. You did a nice job of talking about the importance of, and really the over-prescription of opioids. It's a big problem for us in the VA, but also in the private sector. And so we also know that chronic back pain patients have higher overall costs. Very interesting. When we were just at the Musculoskeletal Summit, you can see that surgical costs are significantly higher for patients, but they spin it to say that this results in increased quality of life, these qualies that we talked about. And so I think that one of the big areas right now is as we look at this, and right now the SPORT trial really is the gold standard. Whether you like their methodology or whether you don't, SPORT is what it is, and they spent a tremendous amount of money, and they have the best data. The problem is that they had an uncontrolled conservative care group. There is a strong need for we who do non-surgical care to come up with high-quality trials, and Mitch is doing a great job. I'm going to report today on our two trials, and specifically we're going to talk about how much it costs to recruit. But I think just as a caveat, and what I would like to see us discuss during our discussion time, is as we all get these very small results, are we spending a lot of money to tell us nothing? Are there better ways that we could be doing these things? And so one of the big problems for anyone who's done trials knows that recruiting patients, screening them, enrolling them in trials is a big problem and costs a lot of money. And we know that if we don't get them in, then that has an impact. And so I'm going to report on our two trials. Our first trial was the HRSA trial, which was spinal manipulation versus active exercise. And both of these trials are now fully recruited, and we actually have the first round data analyzed and are preparing manuscripts. So stay tuned for the results of those. And then this was our sham control trial in older adults. And it is important in this one, and because recruitment was a little bit tougher, that they could never have seen a chiropractor before. Because we were using a sham intervention, we didn't want them to come in with preconceptions about what chiropractic was. And we used detuned ultrasound as our sham, and so we just didn't turn the machine on. And so the ways that we recruited our patients were, I really thought going into this that really all we would need to do is go and meet with primary care physicians, both in the community and in the VA. We were welcomed into VA primary care meetings. My study coordinator attended the weekly meetings throughout the time of the studies. Primary care offices in the community, which we really thought were going to be easy to get into, because of the number of drug reps that have come and because our area is trying to shut down on the number of drug reps coming in, it was difficult for us to get into primary care offices, harder than we thought it was going to be. We certainly were able to get into some offices, but not like we thought. And so the other thing, I really thought that this was going to result in our biggest number of patients enrolled. It actually didn't, and I'll show you the data. But even with us being there and having a physical presence in the provider meetings, just as a quick caveat on that, if I showed up to a provider meeting, we got much different results than if only my recruitment coordinator was there. There was something about the PI showing up that did change the responsiveness and the kind of willingness of the providers to refer patients to the study. I thought that was interesting. Through the VA, we could not do any media, so we could not do radio or TV ads. We did get a local public station to interview me about the study early on, and that did help a little bit, but we couldn't do any of that through the VA. But we could do it for HRSA because we were recruiting outside patients. We had brochures, we had posters, and we did direct mailing. And so these are our HRSA data. And so in HRSA, these two big spikes, so if you remember, HRSA was both VA and non-VA. VA was only at a single site. You'll see in our merit review study we had two sites within the VA. And then there was non-VA. So you see that our biggest bang for our buck in the community was the radio. It was very expensive, but we did do well. For our veterans, the VA publishes a quarterly news journal, which is called Vet Wellness, and that was a very good source for us. And what I'll show you is that direct mail actually wasn't so good for HRSA, but it was excellent for our merit review data. So if we look at the merit review data, this is from our only VA study. Remember, we were recruiting only Cairo-naive veterans, and so we were allowed to mail letters to every veteran over 65 in both Buffalo and in the Rochester-Canandaigua area. So then they got the letter, and then they called us. That was actually very, very effective. And you can see Vet Wellness, which was the magazine. So we got a big spike each time we did this. We only mailed 52 letters at a time out because we would get a big wave of calls. It's also important to recognize in our recruitment that for merit review for the VA study, we were allowed to reimburse patients for time and travel, and so they got $200. And in the HRSA study, there was no reimbursement to subjects. And so that also makes a difference in the recruitment efforts. And so we screened 1,600 patients, 562 were physically screened, and then we enrolled 271 patients in the study. And again, it's important to note that the VA made us do it differently. And so it really turned out to be that as we look at cost per recruited subjects, it turned out to be about $207 on non-VA enrolled subjects. And so when you compare that with other studies, we think that we did fairly well. My take-home point at the end of this is going to be, as we move forward with clinical trials, if that's the direction that we think is going to continue to yield us data, these studies that take place in and outside the VA may be cost-effective, that we may find that we're able to recruit patients better and cheaper by doing studies that are both in and outside the VA. And so another study, this was done at National for their stenosis trial. This was a very small trial. But again, it was fairly expensive, much more expensive than what we found. And so we do think that for the VA, our direct mailing was most effective, and then using Vet Wellness, neither of which, other than postage, neither of which cost us anything. Outside the VA, radio advertising was the most effective, but I think the downside of that is radio advertising can be expensive. And so there are my cows, and thank you very much.
So now the speakers can come up to our table and we'll entertain questions. Entertaining questions.
I have a question for you. Which cow is it?
The chair.
A particular person or just for the whole panel?
It's actually for Dr. Haas. The whole panel can respond, but specifically for Dr. Haas. Categorization of low back pain, is that an inclusive diagnosis or an exclusive diagnosis? So, for instance, if a person has spondylosis or spondylolisthesis, did they qualify for your study or no, they were excluded? That's not a diagnosis of low back pain. So, I wanted to understand what the definition of low back pain was for your study.
It was chronic low back pain of mechanical origin. So we took X-rays on everybody, you know, just to be a little extra cautious. Spondylolisthesis, if it was considered stable, you know, if it was just small, we didn't worry about that. If we saw an anterior lolisthesis, you know, something halfway down the vertebrae, you know, we would have just thrown them right out. Another qualification: if it required advanced imaging to make a, you know, to get a definitive diagnosis, they were out. We didn't have the money for that.
Okay, so it was inclusive. It included multiple diagnoses under a general heading of low back pain.
Non-specific low back pain. That's right.
Thank you.
Questions for Matt. Considering some of the things that Zillit presented in his presentation, do you think your data would have changed somehow, like you speculate, had you been able to tease out whether you're contracted through a hospital-based system as credentialed providers versus solo practitioners?
Good question. I mean, it's always possible that it could have changed. I'm not quite sure. You know, and some of these regressions that we do, it's definitely it becomes somewhat of an art form rather than science. And there will be some sort of issue to look at. We did a bunch of other stuff that I didn't have time to talk about today. We looked at some other influences too, in terms of location of your schools and all sorts of different things as well. We just kind of showed you the stuff that. Interesting idea to think about the future. I'm not sure what percentage of the profession actually does practice in this thing.
6%? I think it was the last practice study from the boards.
As a follow-up, I have a question for that, too. So why is it, it's kind of intriguing, I've seen this several times now, it seems like the northern Midwest is where all the chiropractors are, right? But yet California has the most chiropractors of any state. So something doesn't seem right about that to me.
Well, there's effects of denominators, like, you know, you start
population.
Right, and those populations are probably quite a bit thinner up there in the Midwest. That does have an effect on some of the findings. That would be my guess. Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, and the patterns, I mean, I didn't show the maps of physicians, but it's very different patterns for physicians as well. We're sort of talking it up in the way we're writing about it right now. And that's where the profession started. You know, it probably has a cultural something.
If you checked out osteopaths, you probably would have had a more similar spread to the chiropractors if you separated the osteopaths from the NDs. Historically, the osteopaths.
Well, we actually have some stuff with spine specialists that show us sort of a similar pattern as well. But we had to operationalize that in a certain way. But you always wonder, osteopaths would be pretty fun too, but it's really hard to tease out who's really doing osteopaths.
We also want to include, historically, we had each state allowed licensure of chiropractors. Is that might also affect your
Bill, that's coming.
California, you're right. translates to about 11,000 that are actually practicing. So, but in a large population, but there's a lot of competition from other providers. You've got Sacramento, you've got South Service, you've got Amtrak, California. So, competition demands you look into that.
The utilization, you're saying.
Just so everybody knows too, whenever you start, you're going to start seeing more and more of these regional variation things popping up. And, you know, the devil's in the details in terms of how the model can start. You know, we chose certain factors to include and not include. And, you know, you're sitting there at your computer, and whether or not you should allow things like income to explain variation, it becomes sort of an ethical issue. And I mean, we could build models in ways that the variation shrinks and a lot less red. But we try to sort of take an ethical standpoint in terms of letting population size dictate and the age dictate. We actually held back in terms of public health perspective. We shouldn't allow poorer areas to get lesser care. So it's sort of interesting art and ethical. So you really need to consider what you're adjusting for, what you're letting explain variation. It's kind of dicey.
One thing that we saw in Arkansas, when we were doing task force for health care reform, is that we have both counties where there'd be chiropractors, but there'd be no other resident physician. And so the chiropractor is serving a huge need. And because they're, in my terms, tiny tyrants, you know, they don't have to play with anybody else in the sandbox. So it didn't matter if there was a hospital around or there were any other providers. They went back to their hometown and did their thing, and they were kind of king of the universe. And, you know, so we have huge pockets of chiropractor is the king of the county almost, or at least of their town, which, you know, is another whole different demographic.
I think Monica Smith is looking at some of that.
We have a question over here, then.
Yeah, coming back to your previous comment about the dilemma you have about introducing economics, reimbursements, and so forth. One analog for that, perhaps, that might find some useful in the devil of the details is to look at the variability of scope of practice, which is significant across those states. You can go to a recent survey, for example, we just worked on with Mabel Chang, updating the earlier work was done in the 90s, the scopes of practice variability. And I think you could create a typology or some sort that would characterize scopes as, you know, liberal, non-liberal, or something like that, and then put that as an overlay or an additional variable in your model. You might find it helpful to sort out something.
That's interesting.
So the hypothesis would be that chiropractors go to more liberal states.
Yeah, because when you talk about DOs, for example, it means a universal scope of practice, just like MDs, with DCs. Yeah, how many things can you build?
Yeah.
Rand?
Question for Paul and for Mitch. Correct me if I'm wrong. Paul, you used part of your sham treatment or part of your placebo and ultrasound with the machine turned off, right? Okay. I think that's the right way. Mitch, you used it just with the machine turned down, right?
Yes, it was turned down. We used pulsed ultrasound where continuous ultrasound is recommended and still very low dose. They were getting about 1/20th what would normally have been recommended. The reason we did this is because you would have to otherwise reveal that you're doing a placebo. And you can't blind people for that kind of thing. They would know instantly what the placebo was going to be.
The problem I have is I deal with a lot of the vendors and the manufacturers of ultrasound equipment. More and more they're telling me, just as microstim finally found its place, where equal clinical value to the electrostim, if you will, for the sake of this discussion. More and more, they're saying micro doses of ultrasound are just as effective as what we were taught. Was that we would have been below the therapeutic range, or going way below the therapeutic range, and giving just as good or better effects.
It doesn't surprise me because we did something years ago as part of a trial. We initially gave everybody a sham ultrasound, where we and it was double-blinded, so we had a clinician just turn on the timer, and then a student spent 5 minutes rubbing cold ultrasound gel on someone's back. Then as soon as they were finished, the patient would fill out a pain scale a second time. So just 5 minutes apart. And we had people who were improvements 5, 6, 7, even 1, 9 or something like that, or even 10, something like that, 9 or 10 on a 0 to 10 scale. Now that person was probably black, but still, you have a huge non-specific effect there, and you'll get that. But the change in pain was the same magnitude you'd see if you had measured pain changes before and after the adjustment. We just assumed that this effect couldn't possibly be sustained, that it was just a quick, hey, I'm getting treated effect and go away. Whether it did or not, it's hard to say. But anyway, any of my future trials, the trials we're starting now, no more ultrasound. I'm afraid that that thing
could happen. And with respect to you, Mitch, we didn't turn the machine on, I don't know if I would do it this way again, but because we did do a sham, we did have to reveal that there was a 50-50 chance that they, and we did the Borkebeck and Now scale, and the detailed ultrasound was reliable. Mm-hmm. The equal number of people thought it was real as it was fake. And so, I mean, it did work. It was reliable. But what's interesting in that trial is that we found the same thing. Pain didn't differ.
Yeah. So your problem is we had three things in there. We had two hands-on things and then this extra thing. So it makes it harder.
I've got it. DC PhD acquaintance there who was running a big rehab institute. And she's now suggesting we teach our students that what we used to call therapeutic range for ultrasound is the overdose range. You really should be significantly below that. Now, sure, it's not universally accepted, but that seems to be the way it's going. Mm.
You're talking about like homeopathic doses of ultrasound.
not quite. I mean, I've seen some of that literature also that shows that low dose ultrasound stimulates healing, like microcurrent stimulation, right? So maybe you were actually, there was a treatment effect there, not even just a placebo. That there was a specific effect, not just a non-specific effect.
Yeah, this is actually to Mitch, but all the clinical researchers in the room. So I don't know if you saw Eric Hurwitz's editorial after Bronford's trial. And it's interesting, the title of the editorial was actually, and if Eric were here, I'd say that to him. But he said, is it time for a moratorium on randomized clinical trials for low back pain? And I have to say, given the results of our two trials, given the results of these trials, how much longer are we going to spend millions of dollars to get less than clinical? It's statistically significant, but it may or may not be clinically significant. When are we going to take a different tack to try and decide what's effective for
back? Silence. I think Bart had a question though first, right?
Sure. Or we can do this when we come back today.
Okay.
We got
time. Yes, Bill?
I don't think it's time for more time. It's time to change the going to the same thing. Kind of the outcome you're measuring, but I think we need to be more into the psychosocial realm and figure out what we're talking about. What does this mean to the patient rather than direct physiological, rather than physiology and some of the most obvious things? And secondly, I think we need to dive into the treatment box even more. I mean, we have not teased apart what we're doing biomechanically, we've touched the surface of it. And if we have a former, we cannot discern the difference between
So even Julie and those guys, I think, even though they've spent a lot of time and gotten a lot of bang, I think that psychosocial, in my opinion, psychosocial factors are going to be the big factor, and that there are responders and non-responders, and in responders, it doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah, to add on to what Bill said, I agree with him that a moratorium on trials would be foolish, maybe even a little suicidal. But the thing is, you have to understand that to get funding at the point where we are now, it's starting to change, but where we've been up to now is the funding agencies want to see efficacy trials. Once you've established some kind of efficacy, we can go to something that's more clinically relevant. These are these more pragmatic, comparative effectiveness trials. So what we all want to know is what we do really better than what someone else is doing? Or what part of what we're doing is better than another part of what we're doing? You know, get down to the bottom line. But again, to get that funded, now what I hear is that comparative effectiveness means comparing two efficacious studies. So you still have to do this stuff. And then we're going to, progress on to the next thing. These clinical prediction rules, I've hated them. I think they've all been done wrong. And Mikey can probably expand on that if you have an hour or two to listen. And it was just very... No, I didn't. Because there is a lot to say on it.
You said I talk a lot?
No.
I do.
But with good reason. So, it's very, very hard. People who don't do this kind of research sit down, why don't we just compare this and that, done. It takes years to get this stuff going, get it done. When I submitted that thing 3 times. And it went from being triaged, like, hiss off, what a piece of crap, to in the top 1% of what was funded in NIH. It took several years. And so, there's a lot more to do. I'll stop. Can you take my soapbox away?
Jump off it.
And again, we do got to keep it going until at least when I retire. So.
Yeah.
That's a pragmatic trial.
So do you like my trial comparing activator with standard manipulation? Yeah. So I would agree. I think we can change them around a little bit and still stay within the paradigm of NIH. The other thing that I found out, and Mitch and I talked about this, is you can have your research design done and approved and ready to go, and then a month or two before you get your money, NIH calls you up and says, oh, by the way, where's your placebo group? What? It wasn't in the... Well, yeah, you got to put one in there. We're not going to give you the money. What? They can do that kind of stuff, right? Yeah, and that's another thing that people don't realize, right? That NIH, he who pays the bill controls what's done. And so sometimes either we want to get funded or not, and you have to compromise, and you don't get the exact design you want, but you get the money, And so, in any event.